Hey everyone, this is Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjohn. I grew up in the greater Seattle area and have lived in the Pacific Northwest my whole life. There is a wonderful, vibrant music scene up here with an incredibly welcoming community. Growing up, music was my ultimate passion, but I didn't know how to get started. So this podcast will explore the Northwest music scene, how to navigate it, the resources available to you, and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. This is Made for Music. All right, welcome to Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast and I met back in high school nearly 10 years ago. Since then, he's made his way to and from Canada, been part of more than 8 musical projects, including a few solo ventures, currently active in 4. From pop and jazz to funk fusion, this man rocks the guitar, keyboards, sings, and can half-decently shake a shaker. So please welcome Bellevue High's favorite Canadian transplant, a truly international musician, Antoine Martel.
Hello, hello.
How's it going, man?
Yeah, it's pretty good. How about yourself?
Not too bad. It feels misleading to say 4 main projects because I know you record and perform with a lot more than that, but...
Yeah, but you know, those are the 4 that like I feel as a driving part behind the music making, if that makes sense.
So how do you balance that? I know we'll rewind a little bit later, but 4 projects alone is a lot.
It is. I don't sleep much is really the main answer to that.
The key.
This is a lot of staying up until 3 and going to work at 9. But, you know, it ends up being like one of them is just me. So that's really easy to balance because I'm the only one setting any sort of timeline or anything. The other is me and my other half, Rob Granfelt. So, and for the last year and a half, we've been living in adjacent rooms and now we're moving into a home together, two of us with my folks. So that'll be a continuation of that. That makes that really easy. You know, it's like, oh, do you want to work on this now? And it's like, yeah, that sounds good. And then the big one is the funk band. The funk band is the fusion band. High Pulp is a 8 to 10 piece band depending on the day. And that one is really run by the logistical prowess of Rob Granfelt, Scott Rickson, and Rob Homan. And I just make sure I show up for the weekly rehearsals. And then Suba is, since it's a kind of an international project, then that has a lot less like constraints, but you just have to make sure you're ready to leave sometimes.
Right. And so you're actually getting ready to go on tour.
I am.
With Suba. So can you explain how you became part of a project that is based in Japan?
Yes. So Dentaru no Tsuba is a band that is made up of Jeremy Woolsey. I don't know if you remember him from high school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Jeremy awesome. Woolsey and myself, we were the first two kind of to start working on this. One day, basically, Jeremy came to me. We were living, we'd moved back here after college and his time spent in Japan. And we were living like 10 minutes apart by foot. And yeah, he showed up one day with a couple keyboards being like, hey, there were these songs I learned in Japan, these covers from like the 20s to the 70s that I really like. And I'd love to just do like a little EP with you. I was getting into production work at the time and I could do some recording in a way that he hadn't really been able to do before. So we decided to just do this little passion project for Jeremy, record these songs, these covers for him. Later that summer, I went on a vacation to go see Rob, my drummer friend who I already mentioned, who was at McAllister College in Minnesota. Showed him all the stuff I'd been working on throughout the spring, and he immediately kind of gravitated towards the covers with Jeremy being like, hey, this is really cool. This is really different and kind of far out. And so he was excited about that, wanted to make that a band when we came home, when he moved back a few months later. Just before he moved back, he ran into his friend Dan from college, who was a Minnesota-born man. And Dan was coincidentally moving to Seattle in about a week and a half played bass. So then you had me playing the keyboards. Jeremy's a monstrous guitarist, as I'm sure you remember.
Oh, yeah.
Rob on drums, Dan on bass, came in, formulated the band. So it started out as this cover project, and with Jeremy's kind of long familial history and connection to Japan, his dad and mom having met there, his dad being a translator for many years, his intensive study of it through high school and college, and then like going to live there for a while. It's been a big part of his life. He kind of had the idea of writing original music in Japanese, but about his own life experience, right? He was intrigued by the way that writing in a foreign language that was not his own, one that he felt inherently limited in, would limit his capacity to express himself. And he was intrigued by what would come up, basically what would come of that limitation, what kind of things he would be able to get around. And we were all just kind of really into it. And we'd, you know, with the covers that we'd already gotten really excited about the music, and then the functionality of the band. Every band member it works so well. I've never been in a project that works so well. The four members, everybody had all the skills needed to do everything. There was no tension. Everybody was respectful and intelligent, responsible adults. It was really wonderful. We went on tour. We had an amazing tour down the West Coast and back. And eventually, as we kept going, we started, I mean, the question of, all right, here's four white dudes playing music in Japanese was a big question from the get-go, right? Like, how is that okay, first of all? And if so, why is it? And if not, why not? And that was always something that was heavy on our minds. You know, what's our angle here? Are we being inherently appropriative by doing this? Is this something that we shouldn't be doing? And after about a year of working at this project for really as like kind of our primary goals, we kind of came to the conclusion that it wasn't a good fit in the States. It didn't make a whole lot of sense being four white guys playing music in Japanese to primarily non-Japanese audiences. Inevitably, despite I think what our the best of intentions and the best ways of going about it for Jeremy and all of us together, for as far as like what we're writing about and representational aspects, and not, you know, we don't claim to or intend to represent Japan in any capacity whatsoever. Like, we are not Japanese people. And I don't think that if you know what's going on in the music and you can pay attention to it, I don't think that that comes off that way. But inevitably, because you're playing to a large populace who doesn't know and cannot understand the music, it can be perceived that way. And also had this strange kind of essentializing, I'm not the most academic person, so a lot of these words might not work well, but had this very strange kind of effect where you would get these people who really, really loved the music and really appreciated it, but it felt like the appreciation was coming from an angle that was somewhat uncomfortable. Like, it felt like they were either seeing us in that way as like representative and into it, and that made us uncomfortable, or it would kind of reinforce certain stereotypes that they had about the culture initially. So all of that made us very uncomfortable and made us decide to stop the project in North America. But conveniently, none of those problems exist in Japan, because to a Japanese audience, we're just four strange white dudes coming to play music in their language to them, and not about them, because they know that it's Jeremy talking about Jeremy, right? It has nothing to do with that. So... and all of our friends who were from Japan or like living in Japan, who we showed the music to, really liked it and were really interested and really kind of got into the sound. So that March, it would have been March of last year, 2017, Jeremy moved to Tokyo to pursue his master's degree in comparative art and religious studies, I think. And he was there for, you know, the whole year. And then by the time November came around, we'd always toyed with the idea of like, well, do we try to do a Tsuba tour in Japan? And now like Jeremy's living there, so we kind of have a home base. And then all of a sudden, like Dan, who's also fluent in Japanese in the band, the bass player, was moving there. He moved there last week, ready to go to university in Kobe for sustainable agriculture. So now we have half the band out there, and by the time November came around, we're like, look, are we doing this? Like, is anybody game? And to our surprise, everybody was down. Everybody in the band was like, yeah, let's go try to do this. Let's go tour in Japan. So in 3 weeks, I get on a plane and I'm going to tour in Japan.
Right on. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And so do you have music released there, or is it just, we're going to go hit a bunch of
As of now, the music we've produced and put out so far as releases have all been covers, and that's not super kosher. So we're actually kind of going to get rid of all that. We have a single will be ready before we hit the road. We've been recording an album of original material. Unfortunately, the album will not be ready in time, but that's not that surprising. We worked hard, and it was long and complicated, but there's a lot more to do still. But we have at least one song that we'll have as like a single with its kind of original demo as the B-side. And that'll be kind of what, if people see us when we're there, dig what they hear, they'll be able to go to our Bandcamp, find that, go on Spotify, find that. There'll be that kind of representation of us. And we're hoping to put the rest of the record out before the end of the year. But then we have all this like YouTube live video content and stuff like that of shows that we played and things like that. So
that's awesome. That.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty unique story. I don't think I'll ever... I guess I shouldn't say never, but I don't know if we'll ever hear a story like that about a band coming together.
It was pretty wild. And it was like the first seed of it really was this crazy situation where Jeremy had produced an enormous amount of music when he was in the early years of college. And him and I didn't know each other that well after high school. I mean, we both knew we were two people playing music at the same high school, but that was about it. And I had been listening to it in the later years of my university time and just like really getting into it. And I just sent him, Rob came and visited me again. And all, you know, it's all this weird network of people always influencing each other. But he came and visited me and he was like, man, have you checked out Jeremy's stuff at all? And I was like, yeah, totally. I have been checking it out. It's super tight. And he's like, you should hit him up. You're moving back. Like, we should see if he's around and like play. So I hit him up just being like, hey, do you know Jeremy? Like, I absolutely love your music. I think it's super cool. And like, I'm moving back to Seattle. I don't know where you're at in the world right now, but if you find yourself in Seattle, like, we should play some music together. And turns out at that time, he was living in Japan, kind of unsure about what his next move was going to be, frustrated with how things had been kind of developing for a while. And nobody, to his knowledge, had ever really listened to any of that music or told him about it.
Yeah.
So he was, you know, I get an email 4 weeks later being like, hey, yeah, like, wow, thank you so much. Like, nobody cares about this at all, and I'm happy you dig it, and let's play. And it just was like, you know, an email from Canada to Tokyo is what started the whole thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Let's memento this and then go backwards. So you were in Canada for a bit. You're at McGill University.
Yep.
So how did you... get from, okay, you've graduated high school, and I guess then we'll go backwards again into how you got started, but where did things pivot? Because you said that you went to McGill starting in 2010, but 2011 is when you decided to study music.
Yeah, I'd gotten into McGill. McGill is a Canadian university, a little different than a lot of American schools, I think. When you apply, you kind of have to already apply to what faculty you'll be in.
Oh, interesting.
You don't get to apply to, like, just the school. So I had applied to the arts faculty and the business faculty originally. And I had gotten into both, and I was like, well, I guess I'll go to the arts faculty. And, you know, it's just like social sciences, really. And I was like, because that kind of leaves my options more open. I can see what I want to do more freely. And then by the end of the first year in art studies, I had been taking some music classes and as well as other things. And I had all A's in all my music classes and, like, B's in the other ones, so it wasn't like hard to tell what I cared about more, really. Yeah. So then I found like a way where I could kind of pursue this music degree as like my focal point, but remain in the faculty of arts, and like it made it so I didn't have to worry about like juries, and I could spend more time like recording. But then I also had to make sure I got like a minor. It was all sorts of like different complications, but alas, I ended up being able to study music pretty aggressively for about two more years after that, and then I had another half year of pumping out arts credits to make sure that I could leave the school with a paper.
With a degree.
Yeah. So yeah, that was kind of that tale.
Right on. And so then I guess jumping even further back, you'd been playing instruments for a long time, guitar and keyboard. And so you said you started playing like 97 or something like that, or way before that.
Yeah,
so,
I was five. Yeah.
Yeah, so playing classical piano.
That was the entry point. Yeah, classical piano was the entry point. I don't know if this story is about to be right, actually, so I apologize if I'm about to mess up some dates. But I believe that Titanic came out around like 1996, 1997, circa that time frame.
Sounds right to me.
Around the time where I'd been 5 years old. And my grandma had a piano at her place in Quebec, and I had always kind of, you know, noodled around as a kid. I thought it was fun making noise with the thing, you know? And that book came out, and I learned kind of by ear the, like, My Heart Will Go On, mm-hmm. that little bit, because my sisters, I had two older sisters, they were super stoked on Titanic. I saw Titanic, like, 3 times in theaters, you know, things like that. And I went and kind of, because of that, and I'd been kind of trying stuff out, my parents got the idea that I should try to do some music, and I went and did kind of a trial class with this Georgian piano professor. Her name was Tina Midu. Miss Tina is what I used to call her, because her last name started with a K. And
yeah, fair enough.
I was 5. I don't remember it anymore. But Tina was a wonderful. Miss Tina was really great. First piano teacher, and she taught me kind of everything I know. I resented playing classical piano for so long, which really is because I resented having to work at something for like so long.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with piano now that I'm older and I can see that, but at the time it was very like, it was a battle between my parents and I for the decade that it took. After they had basically, when I started, I was excited about it, as everybody is when they start out. And right off the top, my parents just cornered me. And they were like, well, you have to set a goal, right? You don't get to just start something without any sort of goal. And then this 5-year-old Antoine, who had just seen, like, I guess, I don't know when the goal would have come out, because Fantasia 2000 came out in 2000, and I started playing in 97. Anyways, point is, I wanted to learn how to play Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin. That was my goal. So that 5-year-old Antoine didn't understand the complexity of that goal. And it took 10 years to realize that goal. And I realized that goal, and I performed it on stage, and I walked off stage, and I went right to my parents, and I said, we're done.
Like, yeah.
This is it.
Did they get it when you said that?
Yeah, no, I was like, this is it. This is the end of this trend. And they're like, okay, totally. Like, you met your part of the deal. But our new deal is that you have to keep doing something artistic. We don't care what it is. But if you're not going to play piano anymore, you have to, like, keep this creative, artistic side of you going. So, as a 15, 16-year-old, obviously, I just picked up the guitar. Like, that's the cool thing to do, right? I just wanted to be cool. And I picked up the guitar. And through guitar, I learned kind of a new approach to music, which was more about what I wanted to do and having fun with it and kind of improvising and things. And then eventually it all circled back to being like, oh, wait, I already know how to play piano, and I can do that on this instrument too. So,
right on.
Yeah, it ended up being good.
So did you grow up in a musical family then, or was it just you jumped into classical piano lessons and went with it, or like ran with it?
More the latter. I grew up in a family of people who appreciate art. Both my parents didn't really have... They both come from pretty poor families, so they didn't really have many chances growing up as far as like learning instruments or having the resources to do that. My dad played a little drums in high school, and he downplays it a lot, but he's actually pretty good. He can if I find him alone in a room with a drum set, it's pretty solid. And my mom always wanted to play, so she had that motivating factor. My sister tried for a little bit, but she ended up going the ballet dance route, Evelyn. And then my oldest sister was a pretty good violinist, but that was all before my time. We're very spread out in age, so I never actually, I don't remember hearing her. I know that when I was like 3, I used to dance around her room when she played like fiddle, but that's about it.
Nice.
Yeah.
I had a similar, I guess, avenue into music, except when I quit the piano, I didn't return to it. I quit it for guitar as well.
Cool. That's why.
I think a lot of people would debate that. But
no, it's true. It's how you feel when you're 15.
Yeah, exactly. But my primary motivation was to write. And so, at what point did you decide you wanted to write? And was it before? I guess after you switched to guitar.
After would be really when. The idea of writing, I've always been the kind of musician who has a better time with the ear part and less good time with the reading part. I'm not a great sight reader on any instrument. So, like, you know, that's never been the forte. But, you know, you could put a TV show on in the background and I'd start playing the main theme. And that was a lot of ways I got around practicing for a while. So that kind of inkling of, you know, just kind of being into snagging things and finding them where I could find them had always been there, but it was really with guitar. I wrote my first song when I was like 16 or 17, on a classical guitar and for using my the webcam on my computer was my only recording device that I really had. So I would just like record videos of myself playing these sections really poorly and then like sing over the video of me. It was just like a whole nightmare of it. But it, that was the first real song, and that quickly became the main interest, much more than performing.
I actually just recently found my old YouTube that I forgot I had, and very quickly took everything down. It was like really bad quality and me botching everything and like 30-second talking intros into the cover I was about to do.
But I mean, you know, you got to have that. I think everybody who's a musician has the phase in their life where you go through unhindered creative freedom without the proper amount of skill that you would want, and you just have to have the tough enough skin while doing it, or the ignorance, one of the two really, depending on where you're at, to be cool with that, because nobody's good off the top. You just have to like be bad for a while.
I think it's fair to say mine was ignorance. I hadn't revisited iTunes in a while and found like my band's first record, which was very poorly recorded, was up. Frantically sent CD Baby an email like, please take this down. Like, this no one should hear this. But
I'm sure there's loads of things floating around the stratosphere that no one should hear. But what can I do?
Not much. Everything is like still there even when it's gone. But
the internet is the internet.
Yeah. One day those videos will come back to haunt me. They'll just somehow resurface.
Totally.
But
especially the more successful you get, the scarier that possibility is. Yeah.
So if anyone's listening, there are no videos.
They don't exist.
They don't exist.
Either of us, don't look up anything on YouTube except exactly what we tell you.
Exactly. Yeah, perfect. Cool. So I guess going in chronological order now, you had a bunch of projects between high school and then while you were in Canada as well. So you started writing, you meeting up with other people. When did you realize you wanted to like do this full time? I mean, obviously you were studying it, so in some way you knew you wanted it to be a part of your career, but
I'd say by that second year of university, I had an understanding that this is realistically what I'm best at and also what I'm most interested in, because those things usually go hand in hand. By the time university was over, I had like pretty strongly committed to that idea that this is what I was going to do. And I'd say that year after university was when I worked at Starbucks for like a good chunk of the year. I worked at a bar, a French Canadian radical leftist bar, for a while, and just like lived on very little and tried to make music. That was really the time. It's like I wasn't being nearly as productive as I should have been considering how much time I had, but that was that kind of like gestation period, I think, where I came to the realization like, okay, like this is really what I want to do, and also like, if this really is what I want to do, what does that actually entail?
Right.
How do I go about doing it? And then when I got back here, got on my own two feet, is when I think it actually, like, now this is what I do, kind of happened.
So what prompted you then to move back here? Were you still in Montreal after you graduated?
I was, and the answer is a simple one. It's goddamn cold in Montreal in the winters. The temperature oscillates between -5 and -40 Celsius for about 6 months of the year.
Oof.
And it's not something, I'm a privileged little Seattle boy. It's not something I'm used to. I'm used to some gray skies, a little bit of rain, maybe a couple inches of snow, everything shuts down. And despite my heritage being from Quebec, I was not actually prepared for the climate conditions. And after the fourth winter, I was just like, I don't need to be doing this. I don't need to be here. A lot of my friends had moved away anyways, because, end of college, there's that kind of like drain of your social group. And I was like, you know what? I'll just go back to Seattle. I know a lot of people that make music there. It's way less brutalizing on the weather front. There are some relationships ending. It was all like a perfect storm to just be like, yeah, let's get out of Dodge.
Did that impact your writing?
Hugely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before in Montreal, I was writing almost exclusively acoustic music. And with the transition, you know, any big transition moment, you can kind of choose to reinvent yourself and to whatever degree, or at least you can use it as a jumping off point for reinvention. And yeah, I mean, that's when I started, you know, it's when I came back that I really started playing piano again, thanks to Jeremy, because of Suba, because of the day he showed up with those keyboards, he wanted me to play them. So
that's awesome.
That's how it began.
So have you predominantly been playing keys then, or are you kind of splitting
now here?
Evenly? Yeah.
Now it's mostly keyboards, because, you know, a lot more people need keyboard players than guitar players.
Everyone plays guitar.
Plays guitar. That being said, teaching guitar, a lot more fun than teaching piano. That's why I do that for the day job, because a lot more kids get forced to play piano. No parent forces their kid to play guitar. Kid shows up with the guitar class because they're excited about playing guitar. So it's already, you're starting off from like an easier point.
Yeah. And how long you been teaching for then?
As like a big gig, you know, the big way that I really like make money, probably like 4 years, on and off for like 7, you know. I did some in Montreal, just kind of learning how it worked, figuring that part out, you know.
What is your favorite thing to teach? And if need be, we can break that down like to genre.
Totally. I mean, really, like if I get a student who is already fairly proficient at their instrument and they're interested in learning how to write something, that's when you get to get like Giddy Antoine is like, oh, you want to learn? Okay, well, let's talk about this and notes and chords and theory and circle of fifths and all these things. Like, come check it out. And, you know, 50% of the time they're stoked, 50% of the time they're like, I wish I hadn't asked anything. But yeah, that's probably my favorite, is getting to be like, hey, this is the fun part. Like, this is why you've been working so hard. Let's write something.
Right on. And did, coming back and like teaching stuff like that, sorry, I did my question backwards. Did revisiting piano help with writing? Because I know when I started writing, I was much better at guitar fairly quickly, but my background in piano helped me understand songwriting a little bit better.
Totally. The background in piano really made like college a lot easier. Cause then piano is the best visualization tool for music that we've come up with so far. It's the easiest way to like conceive of all the notes, how they interact, how the chords change, all that stuff. I think it's the most visually simple, and clear. So that was really, really beneficial. And then writing on keyboards has entirely, I mean, it's changed everything about my music. Just go, you know, go to my website, check out the songs before and after keyboards, and you'll see.
Yeah. And so what inspired you then to, say, get into like a funk fusion group? You were doing singer-songwriter or more like stripped acoustic songs, and now you're in a funk fusion band. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, you know, starting in college, I was living with exclusively jazz musicians for most of the time, which was sick. You know, really opened up my ears. And despite being, you know, I was playing all this folk singer-songwriter stuff, but my whole band was made up of these jazz cats because it was who I lived with, and they were all just down to, like, play more basic things with me. So they had already, you know, the influence had started to grow, and in the early times of being back, I just kind of had I discovered J Dilla and Madlib and The Roots and all sorts of amazing hip hop and production stuff. I got really into Flying Lotus and Thundercat and Mind Design and Knowledge and all this kind of music. And I knew that I liked funk just because, you know, you hear the funk and you just feel like you need to dance, and this is just a good feeling. So I knew that was something, and it always looked so fun. There is this band called Busty and the Bass. A little shout out to some McGill folks. They're pretty big now, actually. I look at their Instagram and they're just like playing huge shows and stuff. But they were just a bunch of dudes from my grade who got together and made this like fat funk band, and with a singer / alto sax player. And they just kind of went for it, and they looked like they were always having such a good time while they were playing in that band, like especially in contrast to like the folk scene that I was hanging out in, or the jazz trios or like quartets or sextets that I would see. It just looked way more fun. Really, you know, you could just be like, ah, that seems so satisfying and enjoyable to play. So that had always kind of been in the back of the brain. But to fully understand the High Pulp story, you have to, the foundation of High Pulp was Rob, the same drummer. Rob and I do everything together. And myself, we had been formerly in high school and early college in this kind of emo rock band called New Lungs together. Mm-hmm. Near 2013, I left that band because I was just staying in Montreal. I wasn't coming home, and it was a Seattle-based project. And I was like, look, guys, you know, I'm staying here, so y'all should probably find somebody else. Otherwise, like, I'm just, you're not going to have anybody. I'm not coming back for a while. At that point, I didn't realize that a year later I was going to move back. So they ended up finding these other two dudes, Scott and Garrig, from Fall City. That's not true. They're not from Fall City. they are kind of from North Bend area. And they kind of replaced me in the band, and they kind of kept on doing New Lungs for a little bit. By the time I had moved back, New Lungs was over, but Scott and Garrig were these new friends that we had in our lives. That through Wes and Rob, myself, Scott, and Garrig all started jamming together. And despite all knowing each other from like an emo rock scene, we all had this really fondness for funk and kind of jazz music. So then began the inception of High Pulp. And as members slowly started to get, like, we did that, just the four of us, for about like a year and a half in a basement jam sessions, just coming up with little tunes and ideas. Then we added Andrew Morrill, our saxophone player, who'd gone to college with me, but he was a Roosevelt dude. So he was back here. And then we started adding some more people, Rob Homan, who plays the keyboards, and Victory, and As the Wind, who plays tenor sax. And then as the band continued to form, then it really kind of took shape on its own. And we started gigging in March, and been kind of gigging all year ever since. So
yeah, it's funny because funk, when you see, I think you kind of already touched on this, it's one of the few genres where I feel like people never have to have heard anything about the band or the song to get mm-hmm. super into it. Like you mm-hmm. said, you just hear it and start moving.
Yeah, it's just groove music, you know, it makes you want to dance.
Yeah.
Which is great.
So do you have any favorite gigs that you've played with High Pulp?
Yeah. I mean, you were at that Numo show.
Yeah.
That was super lit. Love the Numo show with Grace Love and Breaks and Swells. Had a huge crowd. Good time. We just played the Tractor last week. And it was right, you know, I'm sure you play around in Seattle. I'm sure you know about the Seattle audiences are wonderful, really appreciative, and they don't dance. Right? They just don't. That's not like a thing that's super happening here. People that's are generally a little more reserved with their movements. You know, it just fits the personality profile. But Thursday at the Tractor, we had some folks dancing. People we had, again, Breaks and Swells was playing with us, and Backside Gospel, and we were the third band, and the energy in the room was just good. People were down with dancing, and like when people are dancing, everything's better. Yeah. You know, like you can just, the vibe's better, you're going to play better because the whole energy in the space is just like more exciting, and you can tell. You're like, all right, I have immediate gratification that what I'm doing is making you happy. Mm-hmm. So like that's a really nice kind of dynamic to have. So that was a really fun one too. Anytime anybody dances,
yeah,
I'm happy.
I'm gonna totally botch this, but mm-hmm. there's a place in Kirkland, I want to say Red Rover, but that's just the camp game.
Okay,
it's like Red Hen or Red Rover, something like that. But anyways, it's
Red Farm theme.
Yeah, I think I went there one time, but I went in and there was actually a funk band playing. Mm-hmm. It's like a Kirkland, and it was not your downtown Seattle crowd per se,
mm-hmm.
but people were dancing and getting after it. They were doing, like, it was funny because they had like a stand-up bass player, and it almost looked like you were going, like, if you just looked at what the people on the stage, it looked like it was more of like a bluegrass mm-hmm. thing, but it was a total like funk show, and they were doing like Bruno Mars covers and stuff like that. But I was gonna say that'd be cool, like maybe that would be a cool crowd to hit, but I can't remember the name of the venue, so so that's that
word. Yeah, well,
I'll get back to you. I'll edit this and just cut myself in of it was the venue. Little Red Hen.
Potentially, there you go.
Thank you.
Potentially the venue. Potentially the spot.
Shout out to Rain City Collective for helping me out.
Nice.
But yeah, so how is that gonna work? You're going on tour.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, I know you said not a lot of sleep, but how do you balance those projects when you're booking for so many different groups? Do you like line up like, okay, these months is me focused here, or is it just constant?
I mean, the real answer to your question is I'm not the one who does most of the booking. So that's Rob Granfeld that I keep talking about because he's my other half. Rob is great at he's very sociable, like just cool dude, easy to get along with, knows everybody. And he loves booking. He loves that kind of aspect of things, which is rad. Because I like sitting in my basement and mixing. And together we make a good team.
Yeah.
so it ends up, yeah. And Rob does, Rob Granfeld and Rob Homan end up doing most of the booking for High Pulp. All of this booking for Suba is done by Jeremy right now because he's the only one living in Japan and really he's got the language skills to make that happen. Sous Chef doesn't play live shows.
I was just about to ask if that is that on the docket?
Eventually, it would be rad. I have no real idea how I would do it. I have like the inklings. I've been doing these weird like solo synthesizer ambient records that are supposed to represent a fake soundtrack to a fake TV show that I could theoretically perform because I actually just like play that on one setting live and can just like do that. And maybe if I had like a visuals guy, that could be like an interesting thing. But yeah, that project is really about just kind of me having a blast by myself in my room and coming up with all the ideas and trying out just different sounds. It's like a very experimental thing for myself. And the kind of events I've done for it have been like, I make visual albums. So I'll have like a visual album screening at my house. And I really want to try to explore more alternative art events for that project rather than gigs.
That's really cool.
Because it would take like a fat band to gig that. And I'm not, yeah. I don't know how to do any of that like producer with any turntable stuff at all or any like Ableton Live performance stuff at all. I don't know it. I don't know how to do that.
It's a whole nother animal.
Yeah, it's a whole thing. And so I'll leave that to the experts and try to figure something else out.
Nice.
And then Sun King, as of now, doesn't gig because we just have too many other things to do.
Right.
And it's just Bob and I. So we're always just like, I will do it later. I will do it later. And it keeps getting pushed back to later. But we have an album and maybe an EP as well. Hopefully that will be out by the end of the year. And then
when you get a second to come up for air.
Yeah, it's just we've been like Bob and I just talk about this all the time because we have like 60 songs and we've been working on it for like 2 years, but we just like never have finished anything. But it's also close. Like it's really in like a good. I just need to really mix it and master it. But then, you know, got to record the High Pulp album, got to record the Suba album, got to go to Suba tour, got to, you know, I end up prioritizing Sous Chef stuff because I'm selfish. so, you know, things like that.
Nice. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. You got a busy, well, due to the tour, busy month ahead, but just busy year.
Yeah.
It's like, regardless of how things go.
Yeah, no, it's
rehearsing or writing or recording.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't sleep much.
Yeah. Yeah. Now's the time.
But tour's going to be great because I have no responsibilities except showing up for the gig. It's going to be wonderful.
Tour's going to be how you catch up on sleep. I don't think many people can say that.
No. Who knows? Actually, I can't speak for other people.
Yeah. Cool. Well, you have these different projects. Like, what inspires you to write? And do you ever have it where you're writing for one project but accidentally write for the other?
Totally. I wrote the song for Suba. It was called Hokai. And it's just totally a High Pulp song now. Like, I'd written it expressly with the intent for Suba. Suba had rehearsed it. We'd tried different renditions of it. It wasn't really panning out. Suba stopped playing. High Pulp picked it up. Totally changed it. New song. As far as what inspires me to write, you know, I don't know. At this point, it feels like somewhat inertia. Mm-hmm. It feels like I've built up enough just kind of forward momentum that it needs to keep happening. And there's this like insatiable need to produce something.
Yeah.
I just need to keep moving forward. But a lot of it too, especially with the Sous Chef stuff, a lot of it comes from like kind of artistic concepts, artistic just little nuggets or ideas. And other people, I have this series with Sous Chef called the Visiting Friends series, and that one is based all on like sampling my friends' music.
Oh, that's awesome.
A, because it's interesting because it'll be music that most people haven't heard. B, because my friends won't sue me over it. and then I kind of put it together, and it creates this interesting fabric of like I usually try to do it kind of friends and then localized. So it'd be like, okay, like my friends who are based out of Chicago What kind of music do they have? What can I draw from there? What kind of canvas can I create with only kind of majority of their sounds plus whatever I'll record on top of it? And then lately I've been really interested in this kind of like fusion. You know, we're doing a podcast, like a spoken word, but not in the kind of like spoken word poetry side, but more in the just kind of like people talking kind of side of things. And I make a lot of instrumental music, but then kind of blending it with this spoken element is interesting to me. And I've been trying to hone it in on different people. I'll make like a record and it'll kind of end up being about a person. So the first Visiting Friends album I put out was Cook County, which is about my friends based around Chicago. And that whole album ended up really being about Jeremy. Jeremy's pretty much the only person who talks on it. It's mostly got his ideas. It samples vast majority of his music. And I finished it and I was making it just as he was moving away. Like, I was losing one of my best friends to, you know, far away. I thought, I don't know, we were going to kind of get to keep going. And it had really inspired me to do that. I'm working on one right now that's mostly about my dad. And it's got my dad kind of speaking the vast majority of the time for the album. It talks about his artistic endeavors. He's a painter, in combination with mine and his kind of philosophies on life and all this sort of stuff. I'd say another one is fear of dying, that death and the inevitable nothingness that awaits us all, or, you know, whatever it may be. I like to think that a lot of times I am making music as an attempt to continue to exist after I'm gone, as I think many of us are. And I have somewhat of a fantasy of being an old man, you know, maybe like, if I'm really lucky, mid 80s, and having this just like playlist that is a pretty interesting representation of my life. Like, if I just listened to everything I made from age like 16 to 75, I think that's probably the best photo album I could have.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought about things like that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Like, it'd be really cool. And especially because you'd see it all shift, and who knows what music will look like in 5 years, 10, 15. And you would know, like, you'd hear that, like, oh, that was.
Totally.
This day, someone puts it on shuffle and you're like, ah, 1999.
Well, and it's such an interesting way to, I don't know, to make note of your life. I think as human beings, that's a lot of what we're trying to do a lot of the times. So a lot of our actions are about, like, be it like legacy or just like countering the inevitability of our demise. And I feel like making music's a pretty nice one.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you.
Yeah.
On that note, we're to pivot to the local scene here. You gave me some of your favorites. So would you mind highlighting, you've got four great acts that you're a part of. Who are some other local acts that you're really excited about or have enjoyed lately?
I think the three that I talked to you about, and there's more. I gotta say, like, I'm not the best about being like super involved in the local scene, or like just kind of super involved in general. Like I said, I like to sit in my room a lot and work on things by myself, which isn't great for like networking purposes or really like friendship building purposes. But alas, there I am.
I'd say four acts is pretty involved in the local scene.
Right. But like, I'm also the dude, you know, who like shows up like just before the show starts, hangs out, maybe talks to a couple people from the other band, like does his thing, goes home. Cause like, you know, I'm tired and I get social anxiety sometimes. But to talk about my favorite bands from around town, huge Heat Warmer fan, big, you know, all three of those dudes really blow my mind, especially Aaron. Just being another keyboard player myself, I love his choice of sounds and his capacity to execute so much all at once. You listen to him like be playing these crazy keyboard parts and synth bass at the same time. I'm just like, you're gnarly, man. You're really, really, really good. And especially their newest record. Like, their newest record, I think, is just primo, primo. Big inspirations from the High Pulp side are the Polyrhythmics. I haven't listened to as much of their stuff as I would want to, but I met Jason because he helped us record our record. Jason's the bass player in the Polyrhythmics, and I started listening to their albums, and just great, great, great musical decisions. You know, just I love listening to a record and the band, the music shifts and it goes somewhere unexpected that feels right, just constantly. And that's, there's no kind of nicer treat than that. And then I think the third I gave you up there was Dexamora. Yeah, Dex ended up becoming, I liked Dex's music, started listening to it maybe like 2 years ago, and immediately kind of was caught on to it, especially because of, you know, his ability to rhyme in addition to his beat selection and musical selection. Again, I'm definitely the kind of person who focuses on that sort of stuff a lot. But yeah, I really enjoyed his productions and kind of what he was talking about. And then when I was living in my house in Beacon Hill, and our friend Lovely one day started, Dexamora walked in my house. And I was like, what? And yeah, and he was friends with Rob and with Lovely. And I got to know Dex, and just like one of the greatest people I've gotten to know in Seattle. Just really enjoyable and knowledgeable guy. Good to spend time with. And then additionally, I already liked his music, and every song he keeps putting out is more and more interesting. So definitely a dude to keep an eye on, as well as there's a bunch of Astro King Phoenix is a guy who I really love, Du Normal, and that kind of same range of folks. I'm trying to think bands wise. I mean, I've always been, you know, a sucker for my friends' bands too. So there was Dog Mountain was a band. I think they just recently stopped being a band, but I helped play on their record, and I love their music. I think they're a really, 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 really talented bunch. As far as other stuff, I'm really blanking. I'm bad about this stuff.
No, I mean, that's a fantastic list. And one thing you mentioned was recording on a bunch of other people's albums. So I guess before we wrap up, do you, mm-hmm. you're really into production.
Yeah.
Do you tend to go into a studio, record there, bring it to your house, or do you record at home, mix of both? Like, how do you like,
I
do you
record
have preferences?
Mostly everything at home. The only times I'll go into a studio, we're kind of building a home studio in the next couple months, which will make it a little more legit, which will be nice. But I mean, the vast majority of what I do is keyboards, which you can just take, you know, get a nice preamp, plug two things in, you're ready to go. So that's really nice. And that means I can just do it on my computer in my bedroom. And yeah, I mean, otherwise, sometimes I never really book studio space. I don't really have that kind of money. I work construction and I teach guitar, you know, like that's not things that I can really afford. And I don't think that, you know, unless you're like, we did a weekend with High Pulp, you know, we want to get like big live tracking sessions. But I really appreciate audio fidelity and that kind of like great stuff. But also like, it's about, you know, just get your idea out there, make it sound as good as you can, move on to the next one, see what happens next.
Yeah. And get people dancing.
Exactly. When you can, try to get people dancing. If that's the vibe, if that's not the vibe of your music, you know, then don't. But yeah, because like if you listen to Slow Glide, you're not going to like dance to it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I guess if people are dancing to New Lung,
yeah,
might be kind of like, well,
New Lung. I mean, we had probably some, yeah, I don't think it was very dancey moments. It was much more of like a take it in sort of band. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, best of luck, man. Headed to Japan, and then you also April 20th got a show coming up. That's the next High Pulp gig.
April 20th, next big High Pulp gig. That's gonna be at the Royal Room, and then I forget who we're playing with. We've got an album release show coming up in June. I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to talk about that. So that's as much as I'm going to say about
that. Right on. Yeah, we'll push it. You can let me know and we'll push it.
Yeah, yeah.
Post episode.
Yeah, and otherwise, I mean, those are the big kind of live events. I'm trying to put out, as far as Sous Chef's concerned, I put out three releases last year. I'm trying to put out 3 to 4 of them this year. I've got a new one that I just finished up the mixing for, second episode of Slow Glide.
Nice.
That'll be hopefully out. I'm aiming for before the end of March, but right now it's really in the hands of whoever is doing the mastering.
Cool. Well, good stuff, man.
Yeah.
Safe travels, and really appreciate you coming out and doing this.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, thanks for chatting with me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So for some context, the song you're about to hear is called Find a True Love, which is part of Antoine's Sous Chef project, which we discussed during the episode. It is a response to The Martian Chronicles, which is an album by Teleporter. Jeremy, one of Antoine's friends who we also talked about during the episode, plays bass for them. And so this song was created by sampling multiple tracks from that album, layering them together, morphing them, and then playing some additional instruments on top, such as drums and keyboards. So hope you all enjoy it. Off we go.
Алушкина. Once upon a time, there was a very beautiful but very lonely young maiden who more than anything else wanted to find a true love. 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 Find a true love.
Wait! 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 Somebody's coming!
Find a true love.
Wait! 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 Somebody's coming! Somebody's coming!
Find a true love.
Wait! 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 Somebody's coming! Somebody's coming!
Find a true love.
Somebody's coming!
Can you see who it is, Jimmy? I got blood in the eyes.
Somebody's coming!
Again, that song was Find a True Love by Antoine Martel, aka Sous Chef. Hope you enjoyed it. And if you want to listen to the artists that we've been discussing during these episodes, follow Made for Music on Spotify, as we're actually going to be putting together playlists comprised of the songs that we discuss on both the local and national level. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please go ahead and rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate y'all helping us out there, and we will see you next time.